should or could be doing. That's what I was doing with the reports from Perkins. Other than giving me a feel for who she was and how she thought, the reports weren't really useful to me. They were about people and aliens I did not know, places I had not been to and never would see, issues that I didn't care about or were already irrelevant due to the passage of time. And most of it was trivia. Yet I kept scrolling down. In my defense, it wasn't all trivia. One report was about lessons learned from working with aliens. The basic lesson learned was that the UNEF contingent of the Alien Legion had a lot to learn about working under the direction of the Ruhar, and even more about fighting alongside the Verd Kris. Perkins had a Verd Surgeon, that is a rank roughly equivalent to Sergeant, training her headquarters security team in Verd Kris tactics. The guy she picked for the job, named Jates, sounded like a hard-ass. I approved. More revealing about both the status of UNEF Paradise and the character of Emily Perkins was a confidential report she submitted to UNEF HQ. It was supposed to be secret, but she must have known the hamsters would crack the encryption and read her words. That knowledge did not appear to have changed the way she addressed the harsh truth. The UNEF soldiers were poorly trained, poorly led, poorly prepared, and were in general no longer a potent military force. Her conclusion was that after years of farming on Paradise, the force's level of fitness was inadequate for the tasks likely to be assigned to the Legion. Units thrown together hastily for the mission on Fresno had no cohesion, no common set of standards and tactics, no... Well, you get the idea. Her assessment of the Verds was only slightly less harsh. Those friendly lizards had no real combat experience, either individually or as a society. The soldiers of UNEF Paradise needed refresher training and to update their tactics to the new reality, but they served an organization that had a strong culture of knowing how to fight. Since the Ruhar had not allowed the Verd Kris to engage in combat or even participate in realistic training before forming the Legion, the Verds were having to make up everything as they went along. Overall, Perkins stated that UNEF was lucky to have escaped the death trap on Fresno. If the Legion had gotten into a real, sustained fight on that world, the situation could have gone sideways in a hurry. She was telling the unvarnished truth as she saw it. I admired her for that. She would probably have been as unpopular on Earth as I was. She didn't need to worry about that. So, I was scrolling down aimlessly, scanning bits of reports here and there. Really, after the first couple reports, I had a better feel for the thought processes of Lieutenant Colonel Emily Perkins, and all I was doing was wasting time. In my defense, my brain works best when I let it wander, so time spent on useless activities is actually worthwhile. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Okay, I told myself, one more minute of scrolling through reports, and I would do something more. Holy shit. Skippy, I shouted. What is it this time? I told you, if you see a word you don't know, just hover your cursor over it and... I can read fine by myself, thank you. You see what I'm reading now? It's a series of recommendations by Perkins, most of which are likely going to be argued about endlessly by UNEF HQ until they are no longer... Yeah, great. What about this one? I jabbed a finger at the screen hard enough that my laptop nearly tipped over. Did this recommendation get implemented? Oh, yes, actually, for two reasons. First, it is at the forehead-slapping duh level of obviousness. Second, UNEF HQ and the hamsters were already considering it. Why? Because. I carefully pulled the laptop back from teetering on the edge of the desk. This could solve our latest problem. Oh. Oh, he added as he caught on to what I was thinking. In the future, when you think there is something I really need to read, please lock all the games on my phone and tablet until I read it. Done. I didn't mean now. I did read this report. All of it? Crap. No. Can you forget what I just said? He chuckled. What do you think? Smythe was with Kapoor in the middle of a training session outside the ship in powered armor when I called him. Our star team commander was more irritated than his usual British stiff upper lip cool. Sir, we are rather busy at the moment. Could this possibly wait? No. Like you told me, time is not our friend. Besides, I know you've run that exercise a dozen times recently. Let Kapoor handle it. I need your advice. There was an unspoken, weary sigh in his reply. Yes, sir, right away. When he got to my office, his hair matted down from being under the helmet and still wearing the suit liner, he stomped rather more loudly than necessary. On his new bionic legs, now that he had gotten used to them, he could walk more softly than ever before. The high-tech legs had shock absorbers built in that not only protected his organic body from impacts, they could mute the effect of footsteps. It was my guess that he had adjusted the settings to subtly let me know how annoyed he was with me. 1 minute later, he was annoyed no longer. Sir, he looked up briefly from the tablet, then back down to study details. This is rather incredible. Fortuitous, I said the unfamiliar word slowly, is how I would describe it. This is like pulling a rabbit out of a hat. With the exception, sir, that these rabbits may not want to leave the hat. He looked up at me again. You know my objections. This could be considered kidnapping. No. I shook my head once emphatically. It's not kidnapping. We will be requisitioning them. I checked the legal stuff with Skippy. I have the authority to commandeer these people from their current mission. Authority? He squinted at me. From UNEF Command on Earth. I know, it's sketchy. Thinking about it made me squirm in my oversized chair. Skippy said that if I have to, I can invoke the stop-loss provision. You know what that is? I know it is a damned underhanded thing to do to a volunteer force. He frowned. My question had been prompted because I wasn't sure if the British Army used the same terminology. Stop-loss was a policy that allowed the military to extend a soldier's enlistment past the original end date. In the U.S., it had been used to involuntarily keep vital personnel on active duty during wartime or whenever the Pentagon declared an emergency. Something like that. Skippy had tried to explain the legal history, but I wasn't interested. All I cared about was whether I had some sort of legal cover for what I wanted to do. The key part of stop-loss is involuntary. A soldier who was counting down until the end of enlistment and making plans to transition to civilian life suddenly was told that he or she was remaining on active duty with no definite end date. That sucked when it happened in Iraq, and it sucked every time it happened. When we signed up to leave Earth with UNEF, we were told the term of our enlistments had been extended to 90 days past the end of the current conflict, which essentially meant forever. We all knew that, and it didn't much matter at the time, because none of us realistically expected to come back home. When we brought the Flying Dutchman to Earth the first time, there was a debate about whether soldiers stranded on Paradise should continue to accrue pay and benefits. That might seem like an irrelevant question, but it was important to the United States government, probably to the other governments of the Expeditionary Force also. The world economy was still recovering from the impact of Columbus Day and from the ravages inflicted by the Kristang. Those governments were paying out checks to the families of the soldiers on Paradise with no end in sight. It seems like a rotten thing to do, but all five governments cut that pay by up to 80% with vague promises that the missing pay would be restored if official contact with Paradise could be reestablished. Which could only happen if our secret was exposed and aliens were about to turn Earth into a radioactive cinder. Anyway, why this mattered was that along with cutting pay and benefits for the troops stranded on Paradise, those people were declared to be transferred from active duty to the reserves, or the equivalent for each nationality. So technically, the active duty enlistments of everyone on Paradise had ended. Fortunately for me, Skippy the Legal Beagle had found an obscure clause in the UNEF Charter that anticipated the force might cycle between active and reserves while off-world. The stop-loss policy applied to reserves also, and allowed the relevant authority to recall reserve forces to active duty at any time for any reason. With both Paradise and our two ships cut off from Earth, the relevant authority was me. I don't like invoking stop-loss either. I'm hoping it won't matter. How so? These are special operations troops. Would any of your people hesitate to join up if we explained the mission was to rescue a group of humans who had been kidnapped off Earth and were being starved? That last part was not entirely true, While the Kristang were negotiating to sell the humans to the Theranin, Skippy expected the lizards would give their slaves at least minimum care to protect their investment. Especially if the AWP might save the lives of every human on Paradise? As Adams stated, the Theranin could develop a bioweapon even without the human prisoners from Rikers. You know what I mean. No. I looked at him in surprise. There was a ghost of a smile on his face. No, he added. None of my people would hesitate to join up. Joining us would be tempting to any operator. The action that truly matters is out here, not with this Legion. That's what I'm thinking. I promise you this. Anyone who doesn't want to join us, we will drop them on Avalon at our first opportunity. Or Earth, I added. Whichever comes first. Smythe gave me a nod that just lifted his chin slightly. Anyone who does not want to join us, I don't want anyway. Colonel, this all looks good. But there will be a substantial amount of work to integrate a new force. These people have a different set of tactics. They have been using Ruhar skin suits instead of our Kristang hardshell power armor. These skin suits. He looked back at the tablet. They do have advantages. Maybe, I cautioned him. Compared to regular Kristang mech suits, Ruhar skin suits have pluses and minuses. Overall, Skippy thinks... I paused, expecting the beer can to join the discussion, but he didn't. He thinks the Kristang suits we use, that he has modified, are substantially superior to skin suits. It all depends on your cover story, sir, he said flatly. Huh? I was lost. Whether we employ Kristang or Ruhar suits, he explained patiently. To plan a rescue operation, I need to know whether your cover story will be that we are Kristang troops or Ruhar. We have to assume we will be detected at some point. Cover story? I hadn't gotten that far along in my thinking. Skippy had pointed out the need for a cover story to explain why anyone would risk military action to take a few hundred worthless humans off an unimportant planet. Oh, yeah. Why? I tilted my head quizzically. Would we pretend to be Ruhar? He continued to be patient with me. The bioweapon is a threat to a Ruhar world, and to a military force led by the Ruhar. They would, of course, have an interest in assuring the humans on Rikers are not used to develop a bioweapon. Crap. Yeah, I see your point. The problem is the hamsters would likely hit the camps from orbit to eliminate the threat instead of rescuing our people. That prompted a raised eyebrow. You think the Ruhar are that callous? I think this is a deadly serious war for survival. I think the hamsters take care of themselves first, and that to them, we are primitive alien pain in the asses. I can't imagine any Ruhar commander parking a starship in orbit and deploying a landing force to rescue a small group of humans. And based on how quick the hamsters were to sell out UNEF on Fresno, I knew Smythe had read Skippy's report. We can't expect them to risk their furry necks for us. Agreed. Sir, it is likely that a rival Kristang clan would also use an orbital strike. The problem is that no one other than us has an interest in seeing those humans leave Rikers alive. No one but us and the Theranin, I muttered. Sir, I couldn't hear that. He had been given bionic legs, not bionic hearing. I said that the Theranin also have an interest in getting those people off the planet alive. The Theranin? That adds a wrinkle. Colonel, to begin planning a rescue, I need to know the cover story we have to sell. To decide on a cover story, I need an operations plan first. He looked pained, like he had just read an announcement that breakfast, lunch, and dinner would be boiled Brussels sprouts for the next week. Smythe, I need to know what is possible. Give me a list of options, and I'll dream up a bullshit cover story for whichever option is best. You may have to choose from the least bad option, not the best, he warned. I shrugged with a grin. Standard operating procedure again, huh? Okay. Before you do that... I turned my laptop around so he could see it. We need a plan to bring aboard a possibly reluctant group of trigger-happy special operators. I don't suppose we could post an advertisement for a luxury cruise across the galaxy, sir. Chapter 28 Hey, Joe, Skippy appeared on my office desk. I have good news and bad news. Oh, man, Skippy, I whispered, dramatically craning my neck to look toward the open door. Bad news is so yesterday. What? Bad news is out. I thought you knew. He sputtered, flustered. You do want to be one of the cool kids, right?
I'm not, he screeched.
Well, yeah, you are now, but people can turn on you like that, I snapped my fingers. That, you know? If people found out, they would be all like, did you hear what Skippy did? You know how people love gossip. Oh, shit. So I can't tell you any bad news? Even if it's important? It's up to you, but... I held out my hands, palms up. Okay. How about I say that I have good news with a complication? People hate complications.
True,
he muttered. Ah! Joe, I have good news, and it's even better than just good because it comes with a challenge. The go-hung nut jobs aboard this ship all love challenges, right? Damn it, he was right. He had beaten me again. Score, beer can 1, monkey 0. Okay, what is it? You asked me to look for an isolated team of Alien Legion Special Operations troops. Human troops, I reminded him. Right, that's the complication. Shit. Do you want to hear this or not? I sure as hell do not want to hear it, but tell me anyway. In most ways, it is kind of a perfect setup, Joe. There is a team of human operators, the Legion calls them Commandos, by the way, in a star system that is one wormhole station away from Paradise. It's a red dwarf system where the Commandos are being trained in spaceborne assault tactics, diving from orbit, all the sort of craziness that Smythe and his team of lunatics enjoy. Anywho, part of the training is for stealth Dodo dropships to practice assault and boarding operations on asteroid bases. The Dodos are flown by human pilots, and the troops are human. No verts? I thought the Legion wanted humans to train with the friendly lizards. That concept still made me uncomfortable. Trusting a Kristang in combat would be a difficult skill for me to learn, though I knew that UNEF had worked successfully with verds on Fresno. That is the goal, Joe. However, the Ruhar want the human Commandos to demonstrate they are effective as a team before they attempt to integrate teams from different species into the Legion. Also, neither UNEF or Ruhar know what tactics and equipment will work best for humans, so the training is mostly a learning exercise. That makes sense. Okay, so, human troops on a Dodo flown by humans and no verds involved. What's the complication? Observers, Joe. Each Dodo carries hamsters to observe, advise, and train the humans. And we risk making enemies of the Ruhar if we Shanghai their people along with ours. Shanghai. Joe, that remark was culturally insensitive and... Oh, bullshit, it's not about the Chinese at all, you moron. Back in the day, shipping companies would kidnap people from the West Coast to fill crews of ships sailing to places like Shanghai. My Uncle Edgar told me about it. Apparently one of my ancestors was a sailor who jumped ship to join the California Gold Rush, but he got kidnapped on the West Coast. My uncle figures he got stinking drunk and they dragged him aboard a ship. He went all over the Pacific before he signed on to a ship going around the Horn to Boston. So this is kidnapping, Joe? You told Smythe this was a stop-loss action or some other bullshit like that. That was a way of sugarcoating the issue, and Smythe knows it. We're going to take these people aboard our ship and not give them a choice about it. They can choose not to serve with the star team. Oh, like that's going to happen, he scoffed. You will give the Commandos a chance to play with shiny new toys. No way will they refuse. Yeah, that's what I'm counting on. Still, they won't be happy that we can't allow them to go back to Paradise or even contact anyone there. By now, they may have families on Paradise. Legally, I do have authority to commandeer UNEF assets as needed, and we sure as hell need those people. No matter how nicely I wrap it in legal language, it is kidnapping. That sucks, and I wouldn't do it if we had a choice. A better choice, you mean? You could choose to abandon the people on Rikers. No, that's bullshit, Skippy. I could decide a rescue operation is not worth the risk or won't ultimately save thousands of lives on Paradise. No way at this point could I choose to abandon the people on Rikers. Because Margaret asked you to? Whoa, That's a rotten thing to say, dude. It's a legit question. You are kidnapping people and taking everything we have into a risky operation. The motivations and emotional state of the commander are a legitimate concern, and you know it. Are you doing this for yourself, for her, or for the poor people on Rikers? Oh, for all three, if you want the truth. If you want the full truth, Margaret asking me to rescue that little girl made me less likely to approve an operation on Rikers. What? Why? Because I don't want to kidnap people and take everything we have into a risky op just to make Margaret like me. Believe me, every step we take down this road, I'm asking myself if it's really worth it, whether I'm thinking clearly about it. Oh, sorry. Don't be sorry. If you think I'm doing something rash and stupid, call me on it. Hell, I do enough stupid things anyway. Besides, there's another reason we are pulling our people off Rikers. What is that? We're doing it for us. The Merry Band of Pirates has been making sacrifices out here, bleeding and dying out here for years. All to serve Earth, to keep the people on our homeworld safe. This one we're doing for us, because this crew can't let those poor people die there without at least trying to rescue them. Even at the risk of exposing our secret and putting Earth in danger? Skippy. Elbows on the desk, I cradled my head in my hands and rubbed my face. Earth is toast. We had a good run, but it's over. Earth would be safe, except Emily freaking Perkins got visited by the Good Idea Fairy and couldn't keep her mouth shut. Oh, wait, that's unfair to her. If I were in her shoes, I would have done the same thing. Except, I told myself, I might have screwed it up even worse. The Maxalts will learn soon enough that their battle group isn't coming back, and they will be sending even more ships. Sure, we seriously hosed their C-3 by making them think the Bosphorok hacked their Pixie network, and that has them on the defensive. Maybe that buys Earth a few more years. Maybe you'll get the backstop wormhole position near Earth and we can evac a couple hundred thousand people to Avalon before big bad aliens drop the hammer. We've done all we can out here for Earth. Now we're doing something for ourselves. Our crew needs this rescue operation. We need to try, you understand? I do understand, Joe. My question was whether you understood that. Oh. Was that you using your mad empathy skills? Do not make me regret this, dude. Sorry. Okay, show me the details. Even if it's bad news. Especially if it's bad news. As a change of pace, Sims and I scheduled our morning meeting in the galley. With such a small crew, breakfasts were fend-for-yourself meals. No one was assigned to cook. Once in a while, I baked cinnamon buns or made pancakes for everyone. It was a special treat that boosted morale, and it was a way for me to deal with the guilt I felt for getting everyone stuck far from a homeworld we might never see again. Anyway, that morning, Sims was there first. She had made a fresh pot of coffee. One item we were not running low on was coffee because she had made sure the Flying Dutchman had practically a lifetime supply before we left Earth. The saying used to be that the Army ran on an ocean of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. The Army also requires coffee. So does any military force. The aliens we knew of all had their own form of stimulant beverages. Wow. Just thinking about that made me wonder what a bleary-eyed lizard soldier looked like before he had his coffee equivalent in the morning. Ugh, I would not want to see that. In addition to coffee, Sims was also stuffing something into a blender and pouring milk over it. She pulsed the blender. I kept quiet until the ruckus was over, and she poured a glass for me. Thank you? I sniffed the pinkish liquid suspiciously. What is it? A smoothie. It's good for you, sir. Drink it. You were going to have marshmallow fluff on toast. She rolled her eyes. I know that. A supply ship came over from the Dutchman last night. We have fresh strawberries. That explained why the smoothie was pink. That did not explain the dark green chunks in it. I said, licking my pink mustache. Interesting. What's the other flavor? Kale. It's loaded with antioxidants, protein, and fiber. Oh. You don't like it? No, it's good. It's just... She looked at me over her glass. What? Dipping a finger into the smoothie, I pulled out several of the dark flecks and wiped them onto the outside of the glass. Putting this stuff into a smoothie makes it really tough to get all the little pieces of kale out, you know? I was on my best behavior during our morning meeting, and I did not drink the whole smoothie. Then I went back to the galley later for a fluff on toast. You need to be careful not to give your body too much nutrition or it gets spoiled. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. We jumped Valkyrie into the Red Dwarf system where the Ruha were training UNEF commandos, using our ship's ability to focus the gamma ray burst so we weren't detected. Our battlecruiser also had better stealth capability than even the upgraded Flying Dutchman, making the choice of ships for the recon easy. It made me uneasy that if we were somehow detected, I didn't have a good reason why our infamous ghost ship would be hanging out in an isolated Ruha star system. Smythe suggested that we explain our presence as the ship needing to refit, and Ruha territory was the last place the Maxalts would look for us. That cover story was okay, I just felt we could have done better. Anyway, once there, we drifted in stealth and listened. First, we listened to detect what objects out there were radiating artificial energy or transmitting signals. There were a lot of them. Next, we listened to make sure our inbound jump had not been noticed, because a sophisticated sensor network, like the strategic defense system around a Ruha planet, might have seen something. Fortunately, the hamsters did not have an SD network in that system, and... No, that's not entirely correct. There were SD platforms orbiting the second planet, but they were just mock units for training. Their sensors were tuned to survey a short-range area around the planet, because that was where the Ruha were training their spaceborne cavalry units. The UNEF commandos were just piggybacking on a much larger training exercise. Satisfied that no one had seen us jump in, we concentrated on the next potential problem, one serious enough that I considered aborting the whole operation. Skippy had detected a Jirapta ship orbiting the second planet. Shit. I clenched a fist. What the hell is that ship doing here? It's not a star carrier. No, Joe. Skippy used his Professor Nerdnik lecture voice. It is a light cruiser, a warship capable of longer flights than a destroyer, but lightly armed and armored. The Jirapta typically employ such ships on missions where they are not expected to encounter heavy opposition. I suspect this particular ship is here to observe the war game exercise. We might risk making enemies of the Ruha. We are not pissing off the Beatles. That's it, then. We're out of here, I declared. Don't be so hasty, Joe, Skippy added. The war game exercise concluded 2 days ago. The cruiser is broadcasting a general alert to warn traffic that it intends to maneuver out to jump distance. More precisely, it was broadcasting such an alert 3 hours ago when the message was sent. It is likely that ship has jumped out of the system by now. The gamma rays have not reached us yet. Okay, we move on the assumption that Beatles aren't hanging around for a second slice of pie. What data do you have on UNEF commandos? Good news and, he caught himself. News that is even better, for it poses a challenge. Behind me, Smythe groaned. What? Skippy asked, baffled. You love challenges. I am sure we will run into plenty of challenges during the operation, Smythe explained. It does no good tempting fate by looking for challenges we could avoid. Oh, well, Skippy sputtered. In that case, you are screwed, dude. The commandos participated in the recent war game, and most of their units have stood down to refit and recuperate. There are only 3 dodos carrying humans that are on maneuvers currently. One of them is near the second planet. I suggest we scratch that off our list. I second that suggestion, I agreed. What else? 2 units in the asteroid belt. You will have to choose between them. What information I have is available to you now. Right away, I eliminated 1 unit from consideration. Smythe, I asked, turning around in my command chair to look at him. He nodded, having seen the same thing I had. Quite so. It will not do. What? Sims inquired. Her attention had been on the ship's sensors, keeping us out of trouble. There's a pregnant woman aboard one of the dodos, I commented without thinking, my focus on data about the other dodo. And? Sims had turned in her chair and was looking straight at me. She's, well, you know. Shit, I was totally unprepared to discuss that subject. She is a dedicated soldier who knows what she's doing, Sims insisted. UNEF Paradise obviously doesn't have a problem with her serving on active duty. Miraculously, because my response would have been followed by another Smythe answered for me. UNEF Paradise will have a place for her when she can no longer serve in a commando unit. We do not. Neither Valkyrie nor the Flying Dutchman have facilities for young children. Then, colonels, Sims's eyes darted between me and Smythe. We should have thought of that before we began an operation to rescue over 100 children.
Oh, crap, Joe, Skippy groaned. I hadn't thought of that.
A bunch of rugrats. They are not rugrats, Sims insisted.
Sorry, ankle biters then, Skippy corrected himself cluelessly. Wow. Damn. With 100 children aboard, the Dutchman will become a super-duper fun-time shit-bus for sure. Hoo boy! I'm glad that will be Nagatha's problem and not mine.
I don't know about that, I admitted, showing how little thought I had put into the subject. Valkyrie is the bigger ship and more well-protected. We might keep the children here.
Dude! Skippy howled. You can't be serious.
Can we get back to the subject, please? Sims demanded.
Listen, XO, it's simple, I pleaded, desperate to end the conversation. There are two dodos out there. One of them has a complication. I'd rather avoid a complication, okay? The other dodo has a more experienced team, Smythe added. 11 of those 18 people are French paratroopers who have served together since before Columbus Day. The other 7 have been with the team for 3 months. That is a good start.
Sims relented, turning back to her station. I am all for avoiding complications.
Smythe caught my eye and pointed to his tablet. I knew what he meant. The first dodo with the pregnant soldier came with another complication. The commando team was commanded by a Chinese brigadier general. He outranked me. Even if we assumed promotions granted on Paradise were not legit, the guy had been a colonel when the expeditionary force left Earth, which meant he had more time in grade than I did. That could be a problem. My response was a shrug. If General Song became an issue, we would deal with it. Anyway, hopefully it would not matter. The commando team aboard the second dodo was led by a French army major. There would be no rank issues there. That made my decision easy. All the info we had on the commando team and the 6 human pilots aboard the second dodo was good. It's what was not listed in the file that bothered me.
Skippy, where's the data about the Ruhar observers?
We don't have it, Joe. The data we have is from transmissions I intercepted out here, and those messages didn't contain any details about observers. To get more data, we need to move deeper into the system. Going into an operation without knowing all the pieces on the board did not please me. It was also standard operating procedure.
There are typically 2 observers?
Yes, Skippy confirmed. 1 pilot and 1 cavalry soldier. And right there was the problem. We would not only be commandeering the human soldiers, an action for which I had at least a sketchy level of legal authority, we would outright be kidnapping 2 Ruhar. They would be treated well, they would have basic food made by Valkyrie's fabricators and whatever comforts we could provide. They would also be prisoners, restricted to limited areas of the ship. To minimize the risk of them causing trouble, the Ruhar would be aboard the Flying Dutchman, and therefore Chang's problem. I felt bad about dumping another problem on him, and I knew he would understand.
Smythe, I say we launch, sir, he said with less than a full measure of enthusiasm. The idea of expanding our list of enemies by kidnapping Ruhar citizens made him uncomfortable. It sounded reasonable given the circumstances, he told me. What he worried about was the law of unintended consequences.
Okay, Sims, launch the packages. Then we'll jump back to rendezvous with the Dutchman for the next phase. After the packages were away, there wasn't much for us to do. I waited until we saw the Jirapta ship jump away, just like Skippy said it would. Then I told the bridge crew to get rest, except for a duty officer and a pilot. My first stop was my office. Then I planned to hit the gym. Skippy still had me locked out from playing video games until I read all the stuff he thought was important, so I was reading fast as I could. In my office, or on the treadmill, or while falling asleep, I had a tablet in front of my nose, reading one document after another. The current file I was reading had only 6 pages left. I planned to ask Skippy to give me a break after I finished that one. Sims came in without knocking. We had dispensed with that because the sliding doors were like 15 feet wide and always open. It seemed silly for people to stand in a wide-open doorway and ask permission to enter. Sims, I glanced up, then kept one eye on the tablet, trying to keep track of which line I was reading. When she sat quietly in the chair across from me, I figured she wanted to continue the uncomfortable conversation we had on the bridge.
Hey, XO. Listen, I have nothing against women who are...
I would like to be pregnant, sir, she announced as she rested her elbow on my desk.
My brain locked up. Part of the problem was sheer panic. The other was the WTF reaction of not believing what I just heard.
From what I learned in high school health class, becoming pregnant involved a particular process, but maybe I was remembering it wrong.
You are telling me this because...
She snorted. You would not be involved.
Oh, thank God.
I mean, I know what you mean, she said, her eyes twinkling. She enjoyed screwing with me. What I mean is, I want to have children someday.
Okay.
I need stability for that.
And a guy, too, I blurted out before my brain could stop me.
Usually, it's none of my business, Sims. Sorry, we've talked about it. Me and Frank. We've discussed it. It's what he wants also.
That's great, I mumbled as a way to stall for time. Why was she telling me these intimate details of her personal life?
She came to my rescue, answering the question I hadn't asked. When this mission is over, when the backstop wormhole is near Earth and open, I would like to go back to Avalon.
Sure, I smiled with relief. To get the colony set up to receive refugees.
That and to start a family.
Frank, he... She twisted to her left and dug into her right pants pocket. When her hand came out, there was a ring in her palm.
Holy sh...
The ring was gold, the diamond was freaking huge.
Where did he get...
Sorry. I blushed with embarrassment. Congratulations.
There was a protocol when hearing about such announcements, I think. I was supposed to ask how he proposed. Was it romantic? Something like that.
The rock?
She held up the diamond to catch the light.
Skippy fabricated it for Frank. A flawless diamond. It's a bit gaudy.
She looked at the ring with affection, and I stopped myself from saying, "You think?"
Skippy says diamonds really aren't worth anything out here, but...
She held the ring above the appropriate finger.
It's the thought that counts.
So Muller proposed.
I automatically referred to him by his last name, though the guy was a civilian.
No, I proposed to him. We're adults, she explained. I don't like playing games. Frank had the ring made to make it official. We're keeping it quiet. I don't want to distract anyone from the rescue mission.
Oh, sure.
My responses were confined to the safest, most bland things I could think of.
When I proposed to Frank, I gave him a ring made from one of the Dutchman's old jump drive coils. That was Skippy's suggestion. His second suggestion, actually.
What was his first suggestion?
That I keep looking.
She laughed. I laughed, too. That sounds like Skippy. Okay, I will need another executive officer then.
It seemed fair to tell you now.
This may all be OBE anyway, you know.
I used the acronym for Overcome by Events. We need to complete the rescue, then go back to see if Backstop got into position, and if Skippy can wake the damn thing up.
Understood.
She still had that amused look. She knew how to make me uncomfortable, and she enjoyed doing it. Not all the time. Just when she thought I was being a doofus.
It's not up to me, you know.
Her eyes narrowed, and the look of amusement was gone.
What is it?
Whether you go back to Avalon, whether the UN assigns you to the Beta site.
She blinked, like that thought hadn't occurred to her.
We,
she meant herself and Frank Muller,
already have been assigned there. Not permanently, I reminded her gently. That was supposed to be a simple and short survey mission. Now the rules have all changed. The UN hasn't even agreed that Avalon is the best candidate for a beta site. It's the only candidate, she insisted. I could see on her face that her dream was slipping away. Sims, I'll do what I can. But you know that when we get back to Earth, we will not be bringing good news, right? My influence will be limited if I have any at all. We might— Oh, screw this! Skippy spat, appearing between us on the desk. Tammy, I mean, Jennifer, if you want to be on Avalon, then that is what's going to happen. Joe, you tell those knuckleheads at the UN that if they want the backstop wormhole to stay open for the evac, Sims gets what she wants. Hey, I'm all for that. I gave him a thumbs up. You tell them. Me? Why do I have to talk with filthy monkeys? Because when we get home, UNEF Command may want to skip a court-martial for me and go straight to the firing squad, you know? Shit! I forgot about that little detail. Thanks a lot, Mr. Buzzkill. That was the essence of Skippy. I was worried about getting the death penalty, and what he cared about was that ruined his good mood. With Skippy, you take what you can get. Sims, I'm very happy for you, and it felt odd to call her fiancé Frank. Mr. Muller, we're a long way from being able to worry about what UNEF thinks. Get some rest. We have a real mission to complete out there. Chapter 29. The next move was for me, Smythe, Kapoor, and the STAR team to transfer to the Flying Dutchman. Our cover story was the Theranan kidnapping an alien Legion team, so we had to take a Theranan ship in, rather than Valkyrie. Sure, if everything went as planned, the Dodo's communications would be jammed so they couldn't signal what they saw, and no one would ever see through our assault ship's stealth field. But knowing the universe had a soon-to-expire coupon for a free sucker punch against Joe Bishop, I did not count on everything going as planned. If there was a stealth field failure, we needed the rest of that star system to see a Theranan ship, or at least a vaguely Theranan-looking ship. So our mighty Valkyrie was waiting in reserve while we took our creaky old star carrier in for the op. No, that was not quite true. The Dutchman was no longer a star carrier, and it was no longer creaky. The upgrades Skippy had performed using leftover Lego pieces made that ship better than when we took it. Better than new. The Dutchman still carried only a limited array of offensive weapons, but it could outrun any ship in the Theranan fleet. Chang told me he was very well pleased with his new command, and I agreed with him. The packages we had launched were probes, basically small missiles stuffed with sensor gear instead of warheads. Well, probes were usually crammed full of sensor gear. The three we launched carried a more special payload. They each had containment vessels with one end of a micro wormhole. The probes were shot out of a railgun to give them high initial velocity so they could save most of their fuel for deceleration and maneuvering when they reached the target areas. Because the Ruhar did not want any accidents befalling the primitive humans operating in their training area, a section of the asteroid belt 1.6 million cubic kilometers in size had been set aside for that one Dodo. Despite the Dodo practicing stealth, it was transmitting a transponder code for safety. My guess was that during an exercise, opposing teams were supposed to ignore the transponders. What it meant for us is that we knew exactly where the Dodo was at all times, and when the commando team left their dropship, they also wore transponders. That was all great, except from Valkyrie's position, that data was way too old. By the time the transponder signals crawled out to us at the speed of light, the Dodo could have moved far away. That's why we needed the magic of micro wormholes. They provided instantaneous communications all the way out to where Valkyrie was parked. Two of the probes flew outward, away from the star. They were the first launched, but last to reach their destination, coming to a halt between the Flying Dutchman and Valkyrie, about 50 kilometers from each ship. Those micro-wormholes provided a real-time link between our two ships and the other probes without exposing the smaller ship to danger, or not exposing the Dutchman to danger before it was necessary. The other two probes? They flew to the exercise area and began listening for the Dodo's transponder.
We now had a pair of micro-wormholes that provided instantaneous communication between the probes shadowing the target Dodo and our ships that were safely waiting 2 light hours away. There was a brief moment of panic when the signal wasn't picked up for 4 minutes. Then the Dodo flew out from behind a large metallic asteroid, and its transponder lit up the area like a strobe light. Success. Except we then picked up 4 more signals. Part of the commando team was down on the asteroid. If 2 of the signals had been from Ruhar observers, I would have been okay with leaving behind 2 of the humans and snatching the dropship. No such luck. All 4 skin suit transponders were transmitting IDs like Renault, Henri. Human names, along with their rank, unit designation, and vital signs. The good news for us was they were assembled on the surface of the asteroid waiting for the Dodo to pick them up. It's a good thing I hadn't ordered us to act prematurely, because as the Dodo slowly descended, 2 more soldiers climbed out of a tunnel under the surface. They were also humans. Whether there were more humans below the surface, or the others were all aboard the Dodo, we had no idea. Using only passive sensors, the micro-wormholes only knew what they could intercept through transmissions, and the commando team was using excellent communications discipline. Based on the tentative flight path flown by the Dodo, it looked like the pilots were following the rules and ignoring the suit transponders of the away team. We waited while the Dodo descended and did not land on the slowly spinning rock. The dropship picked up the 6 people from the surface by employing some sort of hook and tether devices that reminded me of how we had planned to pull our people off the rooftops on Kobamic during our Black Ops mission. Smythe had the same thought and muttered approving noises while we watched. We both made notes to investigate that equipment. It might come in useful someday. As the Dodo sped away, the 6 soldiers dangled behind, being slowly reeled in. 1 soldier was tumbling on the end of her tether, and I felt sorry for Durand, Camille, Capitan. It wasn't her fault. The tether had a flaw. While the tumbling was a deliberate part of the exercise, because the Dodo crew quickly acted to stabilize the tether and reeled her in first. Hopefully she didn't upchuck her breakfast croissant from dizziness. We still did not know how many people were aboard the Dodo, because their suit transponders turned off when inside the cabin. Smythe urged caution, and I agreed. We were on a time limit, but rushing might blow our best, maybe only chance to augment our stars with an experienced special operations unit. The Dodo flew a twisting course, zipping around asteroids. Then it approached an asteroid that was apparently a frequently used exercise area. The rock had derelict structures on the surface, and tunnels dug into it. Skippy said the layout was originally a typical Ruhar facility for servicing mining equipment and crews, but after it had been abandoned, it was rebuilt to a configuration more common to the Kristang. On Earth, we had training sites built to look like whatever country where the U.S. Army was serving most recently. When we weren't caring about political correctness, we called those mock villages Haji stands. Like I said, political correctness wasn't part of our SOP. Officially, the Army refers to such villages as MOUT sites, or they did the last time I was at one. That was a long time ago now. Anyway, it looked like the commandos were going on another exercise, and we watched with increasing impatience, urging them to get on with it. Finally, 19 skin suits dropped to the asteroid surface. 18 humans plus 1 Ruhar who was clearly identified by her transponder. She was clearly an observer, not only from the different signal transmitted by her suit, but by her actions. As the commando team conducted an assault and breaching exercise, she hung back where she could see everything, but was not in the way. Smythe, Kapoor, and their star team watched closely, evaluating the soldiers from UNEF Paradise. They were interested in both how skillfully the exercise was conducted, but also what tactics were used. In Smythe's opinion, the Paradise team was slow and insufficiently aggressive. That could have been standard Ruhar battlefield tactics, or it could have been the hamsters coddling their primitive clients. Or, Kapoor suggested, the humans might be more concerned about avoiding mistakes than with impressing their observer. Personally, my guess was the observer told the humans not to screw up because she would get the blame if someone busted an expensive skin suit. Anyway, the exercise went on for 3 hours, then the Dodo dropped down to land. Recovery of the ground team was conducted casually. The action was clearly over. It was time for a stand down, a hot meal and zero gravity, and maybe sleep. That's what we hoped, for everyone aboard the Dodo to get a good 8 hours of shut-eye, and for the Dodo to be in open space clear of spinning rocks when the team caught up on sleep. Part of our wish came true when the Dodo lifted off and set course for another large asteroid. At the moderate speed they were flying, they would not reach their next objective for another 16 hours. I stood behind the chair occupied by the Dutchman's captain, letting him run his ship.
Chang, tell Kapoor's team to stand by.
They have been standing by to stand by for the past 6 hours.
Kong's reply had a touch of wry amusement. That's life in the military. You get ready in case someone needs you to get ready in case you are needed. In the case of Kapoor's team, standing by to stand by meant they were in or near the Dutchman's armory. My order for them to stand by meant the Stars would get into their mech suits and board a pair of Falcon dropships that were warmed up in the Dutchman's docking bays. The Theranan-built Falcons were not as capable as the Maxulk's Panthers we had aboard Valkyrie, and so I was exposing our small Star team to additional danger. That wasn't by choice. Nor was it by choice that Chang was taking the Dutchman into Shanghai the Paradise People rather than me flying Valkyrie. To explain why an Alien Legion human commando team had been taken, we had to make it look like it was a Theranan operation. That meant jumping in with a Theranan ship and using Theranan dropships. There was no way we could squeeze our people into tiny Theranan combat suits, so Krystang-powered armor had to be good enough. Anyone who saw the sensor data would assume the Theranan made their lizard clients do the hazardous work, and hopefully not ask too many questions. Kapoor's team stood by. We all did. The Dodo cut power and coasted onward, having attained enough velocity that it would need to decelerate hard to slow down before reaching its destination. Still, we waited for the inevitable course correction. If that was needed, and the pilots were following standard Ruha procedure, the course adjustment would happen within 17 minutes after cutting power. It did, and Skippy judged they would not need another course direction during their flight. We now knew exactly where the Dodo was, its speed and direction. I gave Chang the signal, and the Dutchman began slowing and curving around until it was flying at exactly the same speed and course as the target, except our good old former star carrier was 2 light hours away from the target. Chang, I told him as I strapped into a chair in the CIC. It's your call. Chang looked to the duty officer in the CIC, who gave him a thumbs up.
Kapoor is ready, Chang announced.
We're opening the docking bay doors now. Valkyrie, we are counting down to jump.
Sims acknowledged the signal.
Valkyrie is standing by to assist, Sims assured Chang, and I sat back in my chair.
My relaxed move was more for the benefit of the crew. It wasn't because I was feeling confident. Part of me had wanted to be in the command chair for the op. Another smarter part of me knew that would signal a lack of faith in Chang's ability. Besides, if the shit hit the fan, I needed to focus on the big picture and let him run the ship.
Dutchman is jumping, Chang announced. In 3, 2, 1.
We lost the connection to the Valkyrie as our trusty old star carrier jumped. And regained the connection as the Dutchman emerged near our other 2 micro-wormholes, the ones that had been stealthily trailing the Dodo at a safe distance. Our former star carrier jumped in right on top of the tiny Dodo, which was not particularly a small spacecraft. Next to the bulk of the Dutchman version 4.0, the dropship was dwarfed. Jumping in so close was one reason we had to wait until all the Paradise people were safely inside their dropship. If anyone had been outside, the radiation of a starship emerging from the hellish environment of twisted space-time could have seriously injured or killed them. As it was, the side of the Dodo facing toward the inbound jump wormhole got scorched. When we were planning the op, I was nervous about jumping in so close, until Skippy assured me the Dodo's skin would protect its fragile occupants. Once. It could protect the occupants through 1 blast of radiation. That was hopefully all we needed.
Nagatha, work your magic, Chang ordered as I waited anxiously.
Kapoor, launch.
Yes, Colonel, she responded, her voice purring with delight.
Communications are jammed. Target ship is feeding power to main engines, and power is off. Target's electronics are fried, she announced with satisfaction. That last task had been accomplished with a bit of Maxulk's technology, a nifty gizmo that could scramble most types of circuits and render ships, weapons, satellites, and anything else that relied on computers useless. It was sort of an EMP, electromagnetic pulse, except that Skippy told me it worked even on equipment that was powered down. The gizmo was a short-range capability, and it wouldn't work on gear specially hardened against the effect, but dropships couldn't handle the weight penalty of shielding. Plus, none of the traditional enemies of the Ruhar possessed that scramble technology, so they didn't need to worry about it. The result was the dodo we wanted to capture was drifting, and already beginning to tumble nose over tail ever so slowly. I could not imagine the panic of the people inside, seeing a starship emerge from twisted space-time practically on top of them, and then losing all power. In the dodo's cabin, it would be dark, except for the emergency chemical-powered lights. The air circulation system would be off. The familiar hissing of air through the vents would be missing. In the cockpit, no systems would be operating. Their skin suits, their rifles, their Z-phones, none of it would be responding. As I watched the Falcon dropship approach and Kapoor's team fly out the back ramp in jetpacks, my anxiety level climbed a bit. The people in the dodo were not defenseless. Assuming they followed the standard procedures for UNEF Paradise's Alien Legion teams, they would have backup weapons, good old M4 rifles, or whatever the French contingent wanted to carry. Possibly sidearms also, and old-fashioned grenades. Our fancy Maxulk's scramble gizmo could not prevent triggers from activating firing pins and sending bullets down a barrel at lethal speeds. Kapoor's team were in Kristang mech suits, so they had a decent level of protection. They could still be badly injured or even killed by crude but effective bullets with explosive tips. Silently, I urged Kapoor and the Stars to be careful. Six of the Stars, including Kapoor, contacted the dodo and latched on. They had chosen locations away from the main cabin to prevent some panicked knucklehead inside from being tempted to shoot through the dodo's skin to get them. One of the Stars, a graphic at the bottom of the display, identified the soldier as Frey, Katie, Captain, Canada, reached out with a pole and slapped the far end of it onto the cabin's skin. She kept a grip on the pole while flattening herself against the engine cowling to avoid becoming a target. On the end of the pole was another gizmo, this one not quite so high-tech. The box on the end of the pole adhered to the dodo skin to secure its position, then a plasma charge burned a hair-thin hole most of the way through into the dropship's cabin. The amount of plasma was calculated to be exhausted just before it penetrated the inner pressure vessel of the cabin, so right behind it was a tiny drill attached to a wire. Within 2 seconds of Frey slapping the pole on the target area, we had a view of the dodo's interior. A soft light glowed from the end of the wire, illuminating the cabin, where we could see faces that were determined, alert, and anxious, but showing no signs of panic. That was a good sign. We didn't need people who frightened easily. Joe, Chang prompted me from the bridge. It's showtime. Here goes nothing, I muttered to myself. Toggling the transmit button on my Z-phone, I spoke in what I hoped was a loud, clear, and confident but unthreatening tone. Hello, this is Colonel Joe Bishop of UNEF Special Operations Command. From Earth, I emphasized. It was admirable that although the people in the cabin said things to each other, they spoke low enough that I couldn't hear them. None of them shouted, none of them moved from their assigned positions. They all had their skin suit helmets on, but with faceplates up, otherwise they could not have heard orders. After a few seconds, one individual released the strap that had held him in a defensive position behind a locker and floated over toward the softly glowing wire. He spoke with a French accent. I am Commandant Gabriel Fabron, French Expedition Army. You, sir, lie. Earth is lost to us. Commandant was the French Army equivalent to a major in the U.S. military. Commandant Fabron, we came here from Earth recently, I explained. We will be able to offer proof once you are aboard our ship. A Thuranin starship?
Fabrone did not relax the grip on his rifle, but he had it pointed down and to the side. His index finger was properly alongside the trigger. It was a Theranan starship. Now it's ours. We stole it. We're sort of pirates. I laughed softly. Me laughing had him confused. Or maybe he relaxed a bit.
Why should I believe you?
Commandant, I know this sounds like a bullshit story, but you need to understand a couple things. We need your team for a vital operation. I'll explain once you're aboard. Robotic tugs are attaching to your hull and will bring you into a docking bay. All we need you to do right now is strap in, relax, and don't do anything stupid, okay?
Do I have a choice? Fabrone asked warily.
You always have a choice, Fabrone. I used his name in an attempt to establish a rapport. We need you. Your team can make a difference out here. If it helps, you might remember me. I was on Paradise with the U.S. 10th Infantry. The Kristang persuaded UNFHQ to promote me to colonel as a publicity stunt before the hamsters took the planet back. In the dim light, I could see his eyes bulge with surprise.
Merde, he gasped. You are that bishop?
Yeah, I am.
We thought you were dead.
Yeah, well, rumors of my death have been greatly exaggerated. Commandant, this may seem odd, but believe me, we've seen some shit out here that will blow your mind. Hell, we have done some shit that blew my mind. He hesitated, making up his mind. The guy was decisive, a good quality, because he only debated for a few seconds.
Very well. It does not appear that I have any good options. We will stand down.
An excellent choice, Fabrone.
Live to fight another day, no?
He grunted, less than happy. Hopefully you will be fighting on our side. Okay, the next voice you hear will be Major Kapoor of our Special Operations Team. Kapoor's team got the robotic tugs securely attached, then they used their jetpacks to fly a safe distance away from the Dodo while Nagatha tested the tugs. After a minor adjustment, she gently moved the powerless spacecraft into a docking bay. Artificial gravity had been cut off to that section of the ship to make it easier to maneuver the bulky dropship through the doors and down onto the deck, where clamps secured it in place. Kapoor talked the Paradise people through the entire process, including warning them when the artificial gravity plates were powered back up and weight gradually tugged downward. By the time I got down to the docking bay, Chang had already jumped the ship to rendezvous with Valkyrie. We paused briefly after the bay was fully pressurized as a safety precaution while both of our ships jumped far outside the star system. Then I tapped the button to slide open both airlock doors and walked through. Behind me were Smythe and Adams, both unarmed as I was. Kapoor's team had rifles, and all of them had taken their helmets off. The Paradise people must have gotten a shock when they looked out the Dodo's windows to see figures in Kristang-powered armor, so Kapoor had made sure his team had their faceplates set to clear and lights illuminating clearly human faces. Commandant Fabrone, I called out, knowing my words were being fed through the wire into the Dodo's cabin. Please open the side door and come out without your weapons. We're all friends here. Then I clarified to be more accurate. We are all on the same side, I added, tapping the UNEF patch on my uniform. There was no immediate response from the Dodo. Through my earpiece, I could hear harsh whispering going on. The people in the cabin must have been arguing about what to do. Fabrone, I decided to offer an inducement to him. In this year's World Cup, the French team was in the group of death, but they reached the semifinals before losing to Argentina. We have video of the entire tournament. A brief hesitation. Then Fabrone asked, what was the score? 3-2.
Ah, he grunted. No doubt that Argentina cheated. I am coming out.
If it makes you feel any better, the Argies lost 2-0 to Germany in the final, I offered, as the side door popped inward and began sliding aside. Despite my relaxed stance, I was tense. If Fabrone came out shooting, there could be trouble. Under my uniform, I was wearing a thin layer of reactive body armor, but that didn't protect my head or my legs. Bullets could do a lot of damage, and grenades would be devastating. Nagatha should have been able to give me a couple seconds of warning if she detected a weapon in the Dodo's airlock, and I was betting my life on her abilities. Fabrone was smart and acted to assure no harm came to his people. The first thing I saw was his bare, outstretched hands. He had removed the skin suit gloves. Then I saw him without a helmet. He had slightly shaggy blonde hair and a light, stubbly beard that many special operators grew. At first glance, he looked like any other guy you might see, except for his eyes. They were intense, watchful, determined. He stepped out onto the deck, automatically noting the position of Kapoor's team, who were doing so good a job at acting relaxed, it was clear they were not relaxed at all. If the French paratrooper saw any of us as an immediate threat, he didn't react. Reaching the deck, he looked around, saw me, and his eyebrows lifted slightly. "It is you." He stared at me. Tapping my chest, I confirmed. Like I said, not dead. Fabrone's response was to come to attention and snap a crisp salute to me. I returned the gesture with a smile. "At ease, Commandant."
"I do not think I can ever be at ease here."
He looked around the docking bay. We had deliberately parked a Maxalt's Panther dropship in the other cradle.
"This is your ship? Humans fly this starship?"
"We stole it from the Theranin, yeah."
"I do not recognize that configuration."
He pointed at the Panther. "We call it a Panther," I explained. "We stole that from the Maxalts."
"From the Max..."
Now he was openly gaping at me. "Ah, that's nothing." I waved a hand. "It was a package deal. We got a bunch of Panthers when we stole a battlecruiser from the Maxalts. You heard about the ghost ship that has been kicking ass across the galaxy?" He nodded stiffly as if his neck muscles were incapable of movement. I kind of felt sorry for the guy. We had to be blowing his mind. "That's our battlecruiser. We call our ship the Valkyrie. I'd like to give you a tour, but for now, this," I gestured down at the deck, "is the Flying Dutchman. It was a Theranin star carrier before we pimped it."
"Pimped?"
I forgot he was French. "We modified it." The guy stood there, stunned.
"I have missed a lot, no?"
"It's a lot to process, I know. If it makes you feel any better, the last time I met people from Paradise, they had trouble believing it also. Those guys were..." Fabrone sucked in a breath.
"We are not the first people from Paradise you have met? You have been back to Paradise?"
Yeah. "Remember when those buried Mesa cannons blasted a Kristang battle group out of the sky? That was us, too."
"You went back to Paradise?"
"Yes, I had to think. We landed there, twice. Plus we were in system a third time. That's when we picked up a group of Keeper fanatics."
"Keepers," he spat.
Then he added with surprise,
"In system? You did not land? The Keepers were not on Paradise?"
"No, they were in a pair of Lizard dropships headed for Paradise. They had been infected with a bioweapon. We intercepted them before they could do any damage." Probably without thinking, he touched his left shoulder where the vaccine had been injected.
"That was you?"
"That was us. We call our outfit the Merry Band of Pirates," I said with pride.
"You have been busy," he stated.
His expression had changed from bewildered wonderment to something more typical of special operators. Admiration. The Merry Band of Pirates had been kicking ass, and he wanted a piece of the action. I mean, he wanted a piece of the action. No way was an operator like Fabrone going to miss out on whatever we did next. Idle hands are the devil's playground, you know? I don't know if he understood the humor.
"Colonel, if you have accomplished..."
He waved a hand to encompass the docking bay and the ship beyond.
"So much. Then why do you need my team? Why not get..."
He peered behind me to Smythe, who still wore an SAS emblem in addition to the Star Team unit symbol.
"More special air services, or paras from France.
Because right now the Maxalts are blockading the wormhole we use to get back and forth to Earth. Earth is fine. It's good," I hastened to assure him. "The lizards there are dead." That statement was true, except for the frozen lizards. Assuming they were still frozen and that UNEF hadn't shot them into the sun.
We need you because we have a short-term problem, and we need to act fast. The lizards kidnapped a group of human civilians, including children, from Earth. That was back while UNEF was deploying. Some of those people are still alive, but the lizards plan to sell them to the Theranin for use in medical experiments. The little green MFers. It occurred to me that the French might have a different derisive nickname for our least favorite cyborgs. The Theranin want to develop another bioweapon to use against Paradise. The alien legion has got them scared. They want to exterminate humans and kill the whole legion concept before it gets out of control. His shoulders slumped.
Merde.
It's complicated. Fabron, I would not have commandeered your team if I had a choice. Those people, those children, are being starved and abused. They will be tortured and killed unless we rescue them. Colonel Smythe, I jerked a thumb back over my shoulder, will explain the details.
One more question, please, Colonel Bishop.
Sure, shoot. As I said that, I reminded myself that a French soldier might not understand my slang. Fabron understood well enough.
Will this operation involve killing lizards?
Oh! Behind me, Smythe laughed. I turned to see a broad, predatory grin spread across his face.
There will be much killing of lizards and other nasties, I can promise that.
Then, Fabron had a matching smile.
You can count me in. The reason I signed up for the Legion was to get, as you Americans say, payback. I think payback can be better achieved with the Maxulk's battlecruiser.
He shook his head in amazement.
That was what we thought, too.
Skippy was whispering in my ear. I pressed a finger over that ear and gestured for Fabron to wait a minute. Commandant, I told you Earth is fine. That includes your wife Celeste and your son Paul. His eyes narrowed with sudden suspicion.
You know this?
Yes. We have records of everyone we left on Paradise and their families back on Earth. Gabriel, I said softly, breaking protocol by using his first name. The aliens don't know humans have a starship. Our existence out here is a secret. When this mission is over, you and your team can't go back to Paradise. You understand? Hopefully you will all be going home.
Home, he whispered.
The guy's knees bent a little. Technically, that was me giving a promise that I didn't have the authority to make. Assuming Skippy could get the backstop wormhole moved to Earth and opened properly, we could go home. That also assumed we were, you know, still alive at that point. UNEF would likely not be happy about the idea of people from Paradise landing on Earth, meeting their families, and talking about everything they had seen and everything they knew. When we left Earth, the keepers we captured were still confined to Johnston Atoll, a tiny island in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. The keepers had not been allowed to talk to anyone. Their very existence was a secret. UNEF would probably want to keep Fabron's team isolated, too. You know what? Screw UNEF. I was done taking shit from a bunch of bureaucrats who had never been out here. Never had their boots, as the expression goes, on the ground. If Fabron's team survived to get back home, I was not requesting permission to bring them dirtside. The way I felt right then, I wanted to land a damn dropship in the front of the Eiffel Tower and announce to the French people that some of their soldiers had at long last come home from Paradise. Besides, if we did get home, we would be announcing that Earth needed to be evacuated. Having a group of people from Paradise confirming how dangerous the galaxy was would, I think, be helpful. Well, it would be helpful to the thousands of people who could be evacuated before the Maxulks arrived. The billions of other people would not be much comforted by knowing how greatly the odds were against the survival of our species. Crap. I had gotten Fabron's hopes up. When he learned the whole truth, that Earth was ultimately doomed, that was going to be a slap in the face. He wouldn't be looking at me so admiringly then. I really had not thought this whole thing through. Yanking my thoughts back to the present, I repeated what Fabron had said. Home. Before we left Earth the last time, we downloaded practically the whole internet. Whatever you want to know about what's been going on back home, you should be able to find it.
My family?
He asked with heartbreaking anticipation. If they have been posting on FaceTwit, I flashed a smile.
You should find it. Oh, hey. Snapping my fingers, I remembered something. Most people back home who have family and friends on Paradise, they wrote letters and stuff for us to deliver if we ever got there. I'll check if your wife wrote anything, I added as Skippy whispered in my ear that Fabrone's wife had written many letters. Not as many recently, but that was to be expected, I guess. Smythe took that as a cue to step forward and take over. Fabrone snapped a salute to our star team leader, and they had a brief chat, operator to operator. Then Fabrone gestured to the Dodo, and his team began coming out one at a time. Hey, Joe, Skippy spoke in my ear. We might have three kinds of trouble. Before responding, I walked a few steps away. When I heard trouble, my greatest fear was some idiot with a grenade who didn't believe my story and wanted to be a hero. Like what? To start, there is a Ruhar officer hiding in the rear of the Dodo's cabin. She let Fabrone take the lead, but she is very unhappy and intends to make trouble. Is she armed? She has been demanding a rifle or pistol. So far, the commandos have been holding her back. Okay, tell Smythe and Kapoor about her. We knew they had a hamster liaison officer, Skippy. Is the second bit of trouble the other hamster? No. The second issue is that the observer pilot is not a hamster. He is a Giraptha. What the f- People, including Fabrone, turned to look at me. I forced a grin onto my face and strode across the bay, farther away. What the hell is a beetle doing aboard that Dodo? I do not know, Joe. How am I just hearing about this now? I demanded. Nagatha didn't know. The Dutchman's sensors couldn't penetrate the shielding around the Dodo's cabin. I didn't find out until you jumped back here. Does it matter anyway? You already disabled the Dodo. You weren't going to leave them out there in a dead spacecraft, right? No. Damn it, I was pissed, and I wanted someone to be pissed at. Oh, hell, we'll deal with this somehow. Can you make food for Giraptha? It won't be yummy, but he will survive. Great. We planned to kidnap a Ruhar. Now we're making enemies of the Beatles also. I'm afraid to ask, what is the third bit of trouble? Well, that is... Well, here he is now. See for yourself. I did see, but at first I didn't see what the trouble could be. Stepping out of the Dodo, holding his hands away from his sides in a gesture that was unthreatening but not quite a surrender, was a tall black man. A tall black marine. Skin suits could be featureless, or they could employ chameleon wear to blend in with their surroundings, or they could be adjusted to display unit and rank and any other symbol requested by the user. This guy had symbols designating him as a gunnery sergeant, and the distinctive red circle patch of the 3rd Marine Expeditionary Force, in addition to the UNEF and Alien Legion symbols all of Fabrone's team had on their skin suits. His name tag read green, with an extra E on the end. Okay, so he was a Marine. That was not unusual. Why did Skippy think this green guy was trouble? His haircut was high and tight, he wasn't armed as far as I could tell, and he... Margaret? The guy said loudly. What a... Lamar? Adams gasped. And right then I understood the problem. The guy I now knew as Lamar Green strode forward, almost past Smythe before giving our star team leader a perfunctory salute. Lamar never took his eyes off Adams. We all... I thought you were dead. I didn't think I would ever see you. She cringed, a tear rolling down her cheek. Impulsively, she stepped forward and they embraced. No kissing, just hugs. But not the backslapping hug you give to a team member. This was a full-body hug, like her pressing her face into his neck and him running a hand along her back and them whispering something to each other. Shit, I whispered to myself. They have a history, Joe, Skippy explained. You think? I shot back bitterly and immediately regretted.